All right, Philippians chapter 3, and we'll start in verse 1 in just a moment. New Year's resolutions. What's the first thing you think about when you think about New Year's resolutions? Maybe you think about, I'm not going to be able to keep this. I'm going to keep my New Year's resolution. They ought to call it a new minutes resolution, because you keep it for about a minute and then it goes by the wayside. And why is it that so many of our New Year's, and not just New Year's resolutions, but whenever we make a decision, we determine that we're going to do something that's worthwhile. Maybe it's spiritual, maybe it's a physical thing, but primarily spiritual desires that people have and commitments. I'm going to read through the Bible this year, or I'm going to share the gospel with that coworker, that everyone, or I'm going to spend a certain amount of time in prayer. I'm going to set my alarm, I'm going to get up. Whenever we decide that we're going to do something for God spiritually, what's our problem that we fight against? There are three things. It's the world, the flesh, and the devil. Those three things that famously haunt us. They travel around behind us and really inside of us a lot of times. And they keep us from doing the things. And we're going to talk a little bit about the flesh this evening. I've divided, we'll see how far we get tonight. My plan is to get through verses 1 through 15 of Philippians 3. And we'll see if we make it through that. And I've divided these these 15 verses in three sections. So the first, I want to call the flesh. And let's read verses 1 through 6. Philippians 3, 1 says this. Finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord. Notice he says finally, and we're halfway through the book. Finally, my last point, and you still got the second half of the book to go. It's like when a preacher says, and for my last point, and people are like, oh no, it's going to be another hour. Anyway, in closing, or people like check out, they close their Bibles. All right, so finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord. To write the same things to you, to me indeed is not grievous, but for you it is safe. Beware of dogs. And he's not talking about when you go to somebody's backyard. We'll talk about that in a moment. Beware of dogs. Beware of evil workers. Beware of the concision. For we are the circumcision, which worship God in the Spirit and rejoice in Christ Jesus and have no confidence in the flesh. Though I might also have confidence in the flesh, if any other man thinketh that he hath whereof he might trust in the flesh, I more, circumcised the eighth day, of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, and Hebrew of the Hebrews, as touching the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, touching the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. And so Paul here gives a little bit of a resume, if you will. He gives a little bit of a history of his background. And so he starts off by saying, rejoice in the Lord. And then he says, to write the same things to you. What does he mean by the same things? Maybe, you know, he was there and started the church. Maybe he had encouraged them in a certain direction. And now he's repeating himself. He's saying the same things again. And sometimes when people hear something repeated over and over again, you know, like when your mom tells you for the 7th time or the 10th time to clean your room or put away your socks or to pick your bowl off the table and put it away, whatever it may be. A lot of times when you hear the same advice or the same command over and over again, it's like, here we go again. Why do you always say that? And you say, well, have you ever done it? No, but why do you always say it? Well, it's because you haven't done it. And so some people could feel that he is grieved. Like, why do I have to keep repeating myself? But he says, no, it's not that. I don't mind repeating this again. He says, to me indeed is not grievous, but for you it is safe. I'm sharing things with you that are just a good reminder. And don't worry about me having to repeat myself. This is just a good thing for you to hear over and over and over again. And so whether he's talking about rejoicing in the Lord, which he's going to say even again in the next chapter, or the things that are about to come in verses 2, I think he has warned them. I think what he's talking about is what's to come. So starting in verse 2. So he says, he mentions three groups of people that they are to look out for. And by the way, whenever Paul is writing to these churches, telling them, watch out for people, he never, never is a strong word, but he, if he ever does, rarely talks about the world, as in the Roman government. When you're at work, your unbelieving boss, beware of the persecution that they're going to bring. He doesn't really warn people about that. What he warns the church is of people that are coming into the church that lead them astray, or philosophies that they gravitate toward in their area, in the community. You know, he does warn them about spiritual idolatry and being connected with the heathen and all their gods and so forth. But he's not warning them here about Caesar. He's warning them about people that want to creep into the church. So he calls them three names. He says, beware of dogs, beware of evil workers, and beware of the concision. Dogs was obviously a derogatory term. Now, in our society, we say, oh, a dog. What do you think about being a dog? Oh, a dog. Oh, come on up in my bed and cuddle with me. Lick inside my mouth for minutes on it. I'll take a lick of the ice cream cone, and then you take a lick of the ice cream cone. And then I'll put the ice cream in my mouth, and then you lick it out of my mouth. And people are just weird sometimes with their pets. Any over-the-top pet owners? Nobody really weird in here, right? There are those things. Okay. But when he says beware of dogs, back then, when you hear a dog, it was just this mongrel out on the street. People didn't have dogs in their beds with them, and usually they would be running the streets. They were dangerous. They were dirty. You had to watch out for them. In most countries of the world, this is how it is. You go to, I know when I went to the Bahamas one time, when I was at college, I had some friends that were from the Bahamas, and they were horrified when they found out that in America, people let dogs, you know, sleep in their beds, and they feed them gourmet food and so forth. Because in the Bahamas, a dog is just an alarm system. It's outside. If a thief is going to come by, it'll bark, and that's all you have a dog for. And that's how they looked at dogs here. They were just some street mongrels. And so this term of dogs, by the way, different groups of people use dogs. Gentiles would call the Jews dogs. Jews would call the Gentiles dogs. Here, he's just talking about those that are out to do you damage. They're dangerous. And then he says, beware of evil workers. And I think all three of these could be the same groups of people. And then he says, beware of the concision. The concision has to do with cutting. The idea could be of mutilation even. But he's talking about Judaizers that focus on circumcision, that this is, oh, you guys think you're saved? Oh, no, 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 no. Speaking of Gentile believers, you think you're saved? Have you been circumcised? All right, you're not. You need to be circumcised. And it was more than just circumcision. But that was the outward display of keeping the law of Moses. There was more of the law. They're trying to put people under the law. They're often called Judaizers. The book of Galatians is warning about these people. They would travel around. Remember whenever Paul would go somewhere, he would first go to the synagogue in that area, because there were Jews there. And those Jews were hostile toward Christianity. And those Jews, they would try to go after the Christians and say, no, you need to be Jews. You need to, these Gentile believers, you need to become part of Judaism. And they would infiltrate churches. They would travel around. They would follow Paul from city to city and persecute him and try to stone him for saying that you just need to believe in Jesus to go to heaven. These Judaizers, they weren't great Jesus followers. The Jews hated Jesus. They killed him. So that's who he's warning against. But sometimes they would be like wolves in sheep's clothing. They would come into the churches. They would turn people away from the truth. And so he says, I want you to beware of them. And then he says in verse 3, for we are the circumcision. And he's, by the way, this is Paul writing to Gentile believers saying we. He says, you and me are the circumcision. And he's not talking about physical circumcision. He's talking about spiritual circumcision. He's talking about salvation. It says, we are the circumcision which worship God in the Spirit and rejoice in Christ Jesus and have no confidence in the flesh. Now, when he says the word flesh here, he could be literally talking about that, you know, with circumcision. I have confidence in my circumcision. How do you know you're going to heaven? Oh, because I'm... Let me come show you my family tree. Here's my lineage. Da, 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 and we're all circumcised. You know, at least all the guys. And so they put their trust in this. This is how I know I'm going to heaven. Because I've been circumcised. Nowadays, it's kind of like baptism. Only God does command us to be baptized today. But he doesn't... It's not necessary for salvation. But it would be like someone saying baptism is necessary for salvation. Oh, you believe the gospel? No, not enough. You have to be baptized, and maybe even the seven sacraments or whatever. It's adding to the gospel and putting your confidence in that. And by the way, I've heard a lot of people, maybe you have, as you've shared the gospel with people. How do you know you're going to heaven? Oh, I've been baptized. Oh, okay. Whatever. By the way, here's what happens in baptism, is that somebody goes in the water, a dry sinner, and they come out a wet sinner. That's it. You just got wet. And if you don't believe the gospel, you got wet for no reason. Didn't do anything for you. So he says, beware of these people that are doing this. We already have what they say they have. Salvation. He says, we have it, but not the way that they, dropping water bottles and the things that people do. But he says, so I want to talk about the flesh now. There's that angle of the flesh, of circumcision. And then the flesh is in my performance in life. Don't trust in what you can do. Don't trust in your resume. Hey, how do you know you're going to heaven? Well, I've been circumcised. And hold on, that's not it. I also do this, and I do this, and I do this. And there are so many people that are trusting in some list of accomplishments. And he says that as believers, we have no confidence in the flesh. The arm of flesh will fail you, the old song says. And so Paul then says, let's talk about confidence in the flesh. Who has confidence in their flesh? And you could have a raise of hands. He says, if anyone's raising your hand, and by the way, he's not bragging about who he is. He's quote unquote bragging about who he was. And then he's going to set up this image of a person, and then he's going to throw it under the bus saying this is worthless. So when he's bragging here, he's not saying that, he's not really being proud and bragging, but he's saying, let me tell you about who I was before I was saved. I did trust in the flesh. And from a human perspective, I was somebody that could trust in the flesh. That was probably more impressive than almost anyone. So look what he says in verses 4 through 6. He says, Though I might also have confidence in the flesh, if any other man thinketh that he hath whereof he might trust in the flesh, I more. So maybe he's kind of comparing himself to these Judaizers, the Judaizers that are coming in and saying, hey, you ought to be like me. You ought to strive to be like this. He says, if we're talking on a physical level, I can match any of them. Not that we should, but I could. And so he says, here's what I did in verse 5. Circumcised the eighth day. So my family, by the way, Paul is a dual citizen. He was a citizen of Rome, but he also had parents that brought him up in Judaism, and they were Jewish from day one. And on day eight, he was circumcised. He was of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin. I'm not just an Israelite. I'm a Benjamite. I'm a special Israelite. So some of them would kind of rank one tribe against another. And by the way, the tribe of Benjamin is where King Saul was from. And so we were the ruling tribe at one point. Now the tribe of Judah, obviously, is where the kings would come from. He says, in Hebrew of the Hebrews, I would dot all my I's and cross all my T's. As touching the law, a Pharisee. So Paul was very educated. He was a Pharisee that studied under the feet of Gamaliel, probably the top educated Pharisee of the day and a trainer. And he says, and I was on my way to surpassing him even and going to the very top. I was a Pharisee concerning zeal, persecuting the church. Not all Pharisees, by the way, persecuted the church. Gamaliel himself, when they were persecuting the early church, Gamaliel stood up one day and says, you know what, I think we should just leave these Christians alone. And if what they're doing is wrong, then it's going to come to nothing. It'll fall apart. But if what they're doing is right, then we're fighting against God. And Gamaliel was a Pharisee. Not all Pharisees were persecuting the church, but Paul wanted to be a Pharisee's Pharisee. He wanted to be the top, you know, if you're climbing the corporate ladder, he wanted to be the guy that had the most sales and spent the most time doing cold calls or whatever. So I wanted to go beyond all the other Pharisees and persecute the church. We read his story. We won't turn there for sake of time tonight. But in the book of Acts, we see how zealous. He was not even instructed to do this. He went out of his way to go and get letters that he could arrest Christians. And it says hail him. He would drag them by the hair. He would invade their houses and drag them off to prison. And some of them even stoned. He was there the day that Stephen was stoned. He was probably the one that got the whole ball rolling. It says they laid down their clothes. They would take out their outer garments so they could throw the rocks harder. And they laid their garments at his feet. He was overseeing the persecution, basically. And by the way, I heard someone recently talking about this with the Apostle Paul. It says that when Stephen... Turn there very quickly, by the way. I wasn't planning to do this. But turn to Acts... Let's see where we want to start here. Acts chapter 6. So they chose the first deacons, and one of them was Stephen. And look what it says in Acts 6 and verse 8. It says, "And Stephen, full of faith and power, did great wonders and miracles among the people. Then there arose certain of the synagogue, which is called the synagogue of the Libertines and Cyrenians and Alexandrians, and them of Cilicia and of Asia, disputing with Stephen." Now, some of those areas, Saul was from a place called Tarsus, which is close to this. And when there are people that are disputing with Stephen, some people believe that Saul disputed at some point with Stephen. What are they disputing about? We have basically Jewish doctrine versus, which they would use the Old Testament scriptures, but they would often twist them. They hijacked Judaism. And now you have Stephen, who it says is a man full of faith and wisdom, and it says in verse 10, they were not able to resist the wisdom and the spirit by which he spake. And so then they tried to, here's the result of that. Then they suborned men, which said, "We have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and against God." Had he ever spoken blasphemous words against Moses and God? No. They lied about him. Why did they lie about him? Because he made them look bad. He put them to shame. So rather than say, "Man, that guy's got a handle on the scriptures, I believe what he's saying," it's either join him or try to silence him. But he made them look bad. He made them feel bad. Their conscience is pricked, and so they had to lie about him. But they could not resist the wisdom and the spirit. Some people believe that Saul was in this category, and Saul knew a lot. He had a lot of education. But he just couldn't, when it says they couldn't resist the wisdom of the Spirit, they couldn't answer to what he said about the Scripture. They're like, "Yeah, but he's right. I can't say that he's right." They just didn't have an answer. He had a hold on the Scriptures, and he knew how to apply it to Christianity. And some people believe that Saul was in this category. He's well-versed in the Scriptures, and yet Stephen is running circles around him, applying scriptures to Jesus that he has to agree. Isaiah 53, who's that talking about? Jesus. Well, I don't want to admit that it's talking about Jesus because we just crucified him. So what do we do? And some people believe that this is working on Saul, that he's hearing this. Man, I can't answer what Stephen has to say, but he hates it at the time. He puts him to death. And we won't read more about that. But it's often been said that the death of Stephen was the second greatest thing behind the death of Jesus that God ever did for the early church. it did two things, potentially, the death of Stephen. One, it says there was a persecution that arose because of the death of Stephen, and they went everywhere preaching the word. In Acts 1, God says, I want you to be my witness. Jesus says, you'll be witness to me in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the uttermost parts of the earth. You're going to go everywhere preaching the gospel, only they're just in Jerusalem. And so God allows Stephen to be martyred. Oh, horrible, worst thing ever. And it turns out it accomplished God's will. It was a wonderful thing for the church that Stephen died because the gospel went everywhere. By the way, this often happens, that God does something in your life that you think is horrible. Turns out that's what he needed to use to accomplish his will, that he never could have done it in a different way. So that's one thing that happened, is that there was a scattering. And I think the other thing that happened is that Paul's heart was opened to the gospel because he watched Stephen. He heard what he said, he couldn't dispute it, and then he watched him with the face like an angel look up into heaven and praying for his persecutors. I think when he says, Lord, lay not this sin to their charge, that probably stuck like a knife in Saul's heart. That this guy's praying for us. He's praying for me while I authorize his execution. And that leads Paul to become a believer in part. So anyway, back in Philippians 3, he says, I was a Pharisee persecuting the church. And I'm putting this on my resume, but I look back and I think he was miserable at times. He knows there's something about these people. But he just wanted to put them to death. He wanted to put them in prison. And then he says an interesting thing. And here's how we know he's talking about, he's not talking about himself now. He says, touching the righteousness, this is the end of Philippians 3:6. Touching the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. Now, remember what it says about Paul in Romans. He says, when the commandment entered, specifically he says the commandment about covetousness. Thou shalt not covet. He says he's reading that one day and it stabs him in the heart. I covet. He says, when the law came, sin revived and I died. He says, there was a day that the law killed me and I yielded to the gospel. But I had to admit, I'm a sinner. When he says, touching the righteousness which is in the law, blameless, he doesn't mean that he was perfect. I think he means, according to how I thought about myself and how other people thought about me, I was blameless. Obviously, he's not saying that before I was saved, I was blameless and now I'm a horrible person. He was not blameless. But that was his pride. He was looking at all these things on his resume. This is when he has confidence in the flesh until the law slays that confidence. And so he says, none of us should have any of that. Look at the end of verse 3. We are the circumcision, worship God in the Spirit, rejoice in Christ Jesus, and have no confidence in the flesh. He says, I'm going to take my resume. Here's my resume. Everyone impressed? Now I'm going to tear it up and throw it in the trash because it was a waste of time. It never saved me. The greatest things I could ever say about myself, and I was still lost on my way to hell. And once I threw all that away and just believed in Jesus, now I have what I could never in 100 lifetimes accomplish. In John 6, in verse 63, Jesus says, it is the Spirit that quickeneth, the flesh profiteth nothing. He doesn't even say the flesh profits very little. He says the flesh, the things that you do in the flesh, your physical... And by the way, this doesn't mean that the physical body is sinful. Some people go, that's not what it's talking about. It means that the works that we do in our flesh, it profits nothing, zero. Paul said, remember in Romans 7, in me that is in my flesh dwelleth no good thing. I don't have any... I could show you a resume on the human side of things, but there's no redeeming qualities to anything about me apart from God. We have nothing to offer God. We need to be careful as Christians about trusting in the flesh from this perspective. I hear sometimes people say, imagine if so-and-so were to get saved. This rich person or famous person, or they have such a platform. Imagine how much money they could give to God and buildings could be built and things could be accomplished. Let's all pray for this person to be saved. That's trusting in the flesh. That's trusting in human rationale. I've heard people say, imagine if so-and-so, I remember several years ago hearing on some gospel radio station, Whitney Houston was in a movie called The Preacher's Wife several years ago, many years ago. and she sang some gospel songs that then Christian radio stations were playing. One time, one of the songs, I don't know what song it was, one of the songs played on the radio, and then after that, the DJ came on and said, you know, Whitney, she just needs to switch over to totally gospel, because she's just anointed. And I'm thinking, no, she's not anointed. She's giving her life to the world and so forth and singing some God songs here and there. But people throw around phrases and they think, oh, imagine if she would, imagine what could be done for the gospel if this person would use their platform for God. God doesn't need that. And that's why it says in 1 Corinthians 1, not many mighty, not many noble are chosen. Because God doesn't do it that way. He chooses people so that no flesh should glory in His presence. We are to have no confidence in the flesh. The flesh profits nothing. So let's go on back in Philippians 3. And the second section I want to look at, first of all, the flesh. And number 2, verses 7 through 11, I want to call this the fullness of God. Paul says, over here, there's me, little old worthless me. But I want to draw your attention, he says, to Jesus and His fullness and what He brought into my life. So look at verse 7. Let's read down through verse 11. It says, but what things were gained to me, those I counted loss for Christ. Yea, doubtless, and I count all things but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and do count them but dung, that I may win Christ and be found in Him, not having mine own righteousness, which is of the law, but that which is through the faith of Christ, the righteousness which is of God by faith, that I may know Him and the power of His resurrection and the fellowship of His sufferings, being made conformable unto His death, if by any means I might attain unto the resurrection of the dead. So Paul, this section here is really lofty language. It's beautiful. He says, the things that were gained to me, that resume that I just listed, if I bring that to God, say, God, what do you think? You going to use me? I mean, Hebrew of the Hebrews, I'm a Pharisee. And God says, Pharisee? Oh, come this way. You know, nobody can bring something that they are and impress God to where God says, oh, I just... make sure we get Him involved because we can't miss out on Him. You know, some people think that they're God's gift. They're God's gift to God. You know, heaven would be boring without me. That's why Jesus died for me. And Paul says, the things that were gained to me, those I counted loss for Christ. Think about it this way. If you were to have a professional basketball team and, you know, we're going to go against this team, this is going to be our team, and then... for the sake of illustration, you know, Paul brings his resume. He'd be like, for the basketball team, we're going to pick my youngest three sons. We're going to have Isaiah, Elijah, and Noah. And they're going to be on this NBA team and play against these team of seven-footers. And I could say, but you don't understand. You haven't seen how my son dribbles. But if I were to bring that and say, hey... no one would be impressed. That would be loss to bring that and put that on the team. And I'm not I'm not bad mouthing my kids, but they're not basketball players yet. Maybe one day. But if I were to put them on the team, the other team would salivate at that. Oh yeah, he's going to guard me. Oh, I'll step on him, and it would be loss. It would be a loss, a net loss to have one of those three on the team. That's what it's like for Paul. And Paul's got the greatest resume physically. He says, the greatest resume in the world is lost for Christ. If you want to replace what Jesus has with something that we have, you automatically go down. You can't improve on God's plan. And so many people, they want to improve on God's plan. I know the gospel is like this, but what if we add this? Or what if we leave out this? Because, you know, that'd be offensive. If we tell people they're sinners on their way to hell, they're gonna take offense. I've got an idea. Let's skip that part. No, it's lost. Whenever we replace what God says with anything else, our ideas, they bring God down. So he says, yea, doubtless, verse 8, and I count all things but loss compared to this, for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord. So, You can put anything in this category of Paul. Hey, Paul, how about this? How about you have $1 billion? He says, no, I'd rather have the knowledge of Jesus than that. Pick anything. How about 100 million people know you and they follow you and they want to do your bidding? Nope, I'd rather know Jesus. Pick anything that the world chases after. How'd you like to have the best car, the biggest house, the greatest job? He says, everything is lost compared to knowing Jesus. There's nothing that holds a candle to knowing Jesus. And he says, and by the way, I have lost. He says, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and do count them but dung that I may win Christ. Some people believe, by the way, that Paul, we don't have direct evidence, but some people believe that Paul was disinherited by his family when he got saved. That whatever inheritance he was going to get from his father, that, and you know, he was somewhat well-to-do. He was a Roman citizen. He was a Pharisee. Sometimes he had to have connections and money. But whatever he was going to get, some people believe that he was disinherited and he suffered the loss of all things. He got nothing. Or that suffered the loss of all things could mean that, you know, the direction. I was a Pharisee going on the up and up, and I lost all that. I lost, not that he was trying to hold on to it after his salvation. But he says, I lost everything. Now, this is not a verse that when you go to the prosperity gospel churches, this is not the verse they start with. This is not a proof text for the prosperity gospel. He says, hey, why don't you get saved? I got saved and I lost everything. Who wants to be a Christian? You know, the prosperity gospel is you get saved and you get everything. And by the way, people, you ever heard about backward masking? You play music backwards and like certain songs in rock music. I've never done this, but they say if you play rock music backwards, it's backward masking. You can hear a secret message from the devil or something like that. It's like somebody said, if you play rock music backwards, you deserve to hear a message from the devil. But it's also said that if you play country music backwards, you know, country music, you lose your job, you lose your car. If you play country music backwards, you get your car back, you get your wife back, you get your job back. And so Paul's saying, if you play the Christian life backwards, you get everything back that you lost. Paul says, I got saved and I lost everything, and I would do it again. I would do it 100 times in a heartbeat. I count that but dung. I lost it, and I don't care that I lost it. Imagine that you were to go down to Skid Row, all the homeless people. By the way, I don't know if you've ever been to a homeless encampment and so forth. Sometimes a homeless person, he's just got, all he has in the world is like a shopping cart and some stuff in it. Or sometimes you go and they have these old encampments and there's like a tent and the homeless people, and they have some stuff. Have you ever looked at the stuff that homeless people have? And I'm not making fun of homeless people, but this is just the reality. Have you ever looked at the stuff that homeless people have? It's just a bunch of junk. It's trinkets and, you know, here's some clothes. All the clothes have holes in them. The socks have holes in them. The gloves have holes. Here's an old hat. Here's a backpack that's kind of tattered. Sometimes you see homeless people, I've heard about that. I was talking to one a couple of years ago, and he was like being protective, and he says, yeah, some of the other guys here, they want to come and steal some of my stuff. And I thought, only homeless people would steal stuff from homeless people. Because what they have is basically junk. Imagine if you were to go and like adopt a homeless person. Say, hey, I just want you to come, or imagine if a rich person, a billionaire, were to adopt a homeless person. Hey, I want to get you off the streets. I want you to come and live in my house, you know, and whatever you need. And he says, okay, let's go. But hold on, I gotta gather up my stuff. No, you don't need your stuff. I have other stuff. No, but you don't understand. Oh, I have this teddy bear, this Pooh Bear from 1967. Imagine that being snuggled with that. It smells awful. Smells like it's been snuggled by a guy that hasn't taken a bath in a year. And he said, but I just love this stuff. No, it's junk. Leave it behind. He said, no, I need this stuff. Can you imagine going into a billionaire's house with the junk that was accumulated as a homeless person? You would leave all of that behind. It would be lost to bring that into your new life and say, this is awesome. And that's what the billionaire would say. Just set fire to it. just burn it all now. In fact, take off all your clothes, burn all them. You don't need anything from your previous life to what we're going to have now. And as Christians, by the way, we might have lost the stuff of this world. We might have lost valuable stuff that's valuable to the world. Paul says, I count that stuff as dung now. It's worthless. I lost it. And most of the world's like, oh, it's so awesome. And he says, you know what? I have the right perspective now. I've seen, by the way, Paul has seen heaven in some way. He knows by revelation what's waiting for him there. And what we have, you know, everything that we lose is going to be replaced and then some by God. It might not be replaced physically now, but imagine that the homeless person on the journey. So he's leaving the homeless encampment and he's going to the billionaire's house. And along the way, he's so sorrowful. Oh, I don't have any stuff. I lost all my stuff. My backpack, it's got all my stuff in there. It's got my wallet. It's got like 3 pennies in there. And he's just thinking about, on the way to the billionaire's house, he's thinking, oh, what about my stuff? You don't need it. And that trip is like our journey through the Christian life. We might not have a lot, but we have our citizenship in heaven. We're not even citizens of this earth anymore. So who cares if we don't have stuff? But we're so tied to the world. Imagine this homeless person being dragged into the billionaire's house, clinging to his junk. And that's the picture of Christians that can't let go of the things of the world or are upset if they might lose something. And now Paul's got his perspective. He says, I realize that everything that I was... Imagine the homeless person saying, bringing to the billionaire, hey, look at my backpack. You got a special place in your closet for this? And but what things were gained to me, those I counted loss. I've been holding on to junk my whole life, and I've finally been liberated from it. And so let's read. We won't go on tonight, but let's finish with verse. I want to read verse 8 one more time. He says, yea, doubtless, and I count all things but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and do count them but dung that I may win Christ. When he says win Christ, he's not talking about a work salvation. That's done. I do believe in part he's talking about rewards and crowns and standing in heaven. But he says, I want to know, and next week we'll get to verse 11 or verse 10, which says, I want to know him more. The knowledge of him is the greatest thing. I was holding on to junk. I've dropped that and I don't care about it. And people scratch their heads. How can you be dirt poor and be so happy? Because I know Jesus and I want to know him more. And he's holding that up as an example. Again, to tie it back in from the beginning of the chapter, he says, watch out for these Judaizers that come in. People that try to talk you out of the freedom and the simplicity of the gospel, and they try to add these things. Don't worry about all that junk. Don't worry about stuff. Know Jesus. Have you lost anything spiritually? Have you lost anything physically in your life? Maybe you've lost the admiration of certain people that are unbelievers. Oh, I open my mouth for the gospel and they look at me like I'm weird. And you've lost respect. By the way, there's a certain kind of respect that you lose, but there's also a certain kind of respect that sometimes they have for you secretly. Oh, I wish I had what he had. I wish I had that joy. I wish I had that confidence and that assurance that they have. But maybe you've lost certain things. Leave it all behind. It doesn't matter. The greatest thing is knowing Jesus. And we'll come back to that next week. Paul says, that I may know him. And we'll pick it up with that next week. Let's close together in prayer.